Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I've got to begin today with a language advisory. On today's show, I am going to say the words moist, impactful, and I might say irregardless. We will try to find out why we hate certain words. So that's coming up. There's also a word choice in our top story. Is the word diplomats or is it spies? I'm talking here about the White House shutting down the Russian consulate in Seattle. The State Department says there are intelligence agents working at the consulate, and they're too close to sensitive locations like Boeing plants and the U.S. Naval Base in Kitsap County. So here to help you understand this is Professor Don Hellman, a foreign policy expert at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. I asked Hellman if he believes the State Department's explanation for why it's closing the Seattle consulate.
Geographically, that's accurate. But in terms of its function, I think that while that's true, I mean, it's hardly just an outpost to have an ear next to the military deployments and builders in the area where the Cold War is over. And that is of interest, obviously. But the role of a consulate is much broader than that. It's to be sure, establishing a presence that is proximate, if possible, to political and strategic institutions. But it basically, its job is to deal with visitors, the immigrant community that's here, and above all to economics, to trade involving, and of course, communication with Russia. And we're Russia does not have much trade with the United States at all, but Seattle is one of the places that does, and that's really its official job.
But the White House is suggesting that these, you can call them diplomats, but the White House regards them as intelligence agents or spies. Are there Russian spies in Seattle?
I'm sure there are. I'm sure that this has been known from the time the embassy was set up. We have our spies in not only Russia, but in other countries. And the practice of throwing them out when a red line is crossed diplomatically is very common. Britain already has done it. Obama did it in the last days of his presidency.
Well, do you think if they're spies in Seattle, do you think that they have been using their geographic proximity to Boeing and/or the naval base in Kitsap County?
I would expect they would have their ears flapping and their eyes open, not only regarding those military or military-related institutions, but also on technology. Because in the modern world, intelligence is increasingly intellectual property regarding the digital thing, and we are the Silicon Forest, if you want to put it that way. So yes, they did the other, but I stressing the military component of it, I think, is distorting a bit of what a consulate really does.
So if we assume that's true, why do we allow consulates in our cities? Do we just figure, well, that's the price of doing international trade and immigration, you got to have spies in your town?
Well, this is a practice that's gone on for a long time. We do it. Usually, particularly in embassies, the so-called military attachés is the title, invariably are intelligence operatives for, if not the CIA, the DIA, or some other intelligence agency, NSA, and so forth. It's a common practice that all countries, particularly great powers, do. And you expect that. I think they said 14 or so representatives to the United Nations from Russia were expelled. Mm. I mean, and so it's, you know, if you're here, you're there. Yes.
What effect does the closing of the Russian consulate in Seattle have, given that the San Francisco consulate also closed just several months ago in a diplomatic dispute with Russia?
I know this will not go sit well with the Seattle audience, but if they close the consulate as a consequence of this virtually unanimous passage of sanctions
over the Russian election meddling. That was the argument.
Russian meddling. We're a throwaway. I mean,
Seattle's a throwaway. What do you mean?
Well, it is symbolic, but it is not as costly. If they're willing to absorb the disruptive such as it is, effect of closing a consulate the size of San Francisco, closing the Seattle consulate is only marginally comparable.
That line's already been crossed.
That's been crossed, yes.
How big an inconvenience is it to Seattle area Russians and their families to not have a consulate in either Seattle or San Francisco?
Well, we do not have extensive investment or businesses here the way, for example, we do with China, which is an analogous. And so it will certainly curtail or inhibit, I think the right word is inhibit, expansion of business. It will inconvenience people who wish to return to Russia. I mean, you have to have a visa and so on. So I assume the visa thing is still here, but maybe not. It will not have a profound effect. It is symbolic. It's a pain. It's an inconvenience. And it's, I think the importance of doing it is, from our point of view, from the American point of view, is simply to send a signal that we're changing. I mean, that's the real significance.
Okay, well, let's talk about that significant signal then. Because as far as I know, this could just be diplomatic window dressing. It's a little dance. As you said, it's happened before. So I'd like to know from you, how does expelling 60 Russian diplomats / spies, how does that either punish or pressure Russia?
Well, I think what is interesting about this particular action, apart from the fact that we did it contrary to what the president has been saying to Putin, is that it was coordinated with many other countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were 11 European countries, none from Asia, but Eastern Europe as well as Canada did it as well. So it was clearly a multilateral gesture saying that what had happened in England, in Great Britain, was so severe and so out of step. I mean, it happened before. I mean, he poisoned another, he killed another individual earlier. And moreover, Putin has taken a very aggressive diplomatic and military posture in not only Syria, he's now proposing building a bridge between North Korea and Russia, and in various ways has in snuggling up to Iran. I mean, that's if Trump proceeds to end the agreement with Iran, which of course Russia is a signatory, this will not only probably set off Iran to do what they want to do, which is probably develop enriched uranium in particular, but it will strengthen the hand of the Russians there. And now, I assume this multilateral gesture is signaling that everybody in Europe, in particular, is in Ukraine even jumped in. But all of this is very, you know, they sent one diplomat or three diplomats or four diplomats. It's not anywhere near as comprehensive or as important as what the United States did. But it nevertheless was multilateral, and it's a signal to Putin that he's crossed the red line. And
well, what is that red line? What's the harm to Russia?
Well,
to nothing, have to lose,
there, is
to lose
no, there is no tangible harm except symbolic. I mean, a Russian ambassador has to have a press conference saying this is counterproductive and inconsistent with the White House. And these other countries, it's unclear as to what subsequent measures will be taken either by Russia or by them. My guess is the Russians will clearly respond in one way or another, and they can do so in Europe primarily because so much of Europe is dependent on energy, gas in particular, that comes from Russia. And so they're a little softer on it, but nevertheless, they're sending a signal. And what's amazing about this is that the costs to them, or the potential costs to them, are significantly greater than they are to the United States because of their economic dependence on energy from Russia and other connections as well.
But if this is the expelling diplomats, if it's symbolic, then why would Russia go from that to an escalation like withholding their natural gas.
Because it's an issue of sovereignty. I mean, Putin is a nationalist. And I mean, he's got an economy the size of Italy. He can still blow the world up nuclearly, of course. And he's projecting military power in Syria and in other parts of the Middle East that are great power stuff. I mean, it's openly defined. Now, he's got certain troubles. Assad is behaving independently of him. It's Russian nationalism. You can't be insulted politically. Putin is trading on his capacity to quite successful to outmaneuver us, despite the fact he has resources that are in no way commensurate with those of the United States or even Western Europe or China.
But Vladimir Putin, who just got quote unquote reelected by landslide, right? He cares whether does the average Russian citizen care whether or no that that some countries expelled some Russian diplomats? And boy, they're really going to hold Putin's feet to the fire for that.
Well, they're not going to hold Putin's feet to the fire, but Putin has traded on the idea that the West is against us in the Ukraine, because Crimea, obviously, and so on. And part of his nationalist appeal is to use this. Now, this is not universal. I mean, the election was obviously fixed, but it does have appeal to a significant proportion of the Russian population. And of course, by controlling information flows, he assures that and how the election is held, that is expressed. And so this is really a reinforcement of what he's already been doing.
Okay, so finally, and this is conjecture, but Professor, do you expect that we're going to look back at this moment, the closing of the Russian consulate in Seattle, the expulsion of diplomats by all these different countries, including President Trump, do you expect we'll look back at this as having been some kind of turning point, some kind of significant development, or will it be a piece of trivia that, oh, yeah, there was some diplomatic tit for tat back in the 2018s?
This is conjecture on my part, as you imply, but the dramatic shift in American policy is also correlated with a dramatic shift in who is whispering in the ear of the president about foreign policy. Both Pompeo and now John Bolton are anti-Russian.
The new national security advisor.
Yes, and they're both anti-Russian and have opinions quite contrary to what the president has expressed to Putin. The so-called Russian investigation on their participation in our rigging, trying to rig our election of 2016, there's unanimous agreement among our intelligence agencies that they did this and that this is utterly unacceptable. Moreover, the Russians are doing it in France and they apparently did it in Brexit and so on. So the answer to your question is maybe the appointment of these new group people to be close to the president on foreign policy, who have opinions quite different from his, was a contributing factor. It may have been, as you implicitly suggest, a threshold that what Putin is doing, which is literally unbound. Now, he doesn't care. I mean, we killed 200 Russians mercenaries in Syria just about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, that the gas, you know, Assad is using gas and so on and so forth, even though he's an ally of Russia. So his behavior, and symbolized most importantly by, of course, the attempt to kill these former Russian citizens in London, really has gone so far that it may actually have created a threshold, and we'll see. It'll depend on many things, unfortunately, both how we deal with North Korea, and how we deal with Iran. And it will be derivative from those events as much as it will be from our policy decisions.
Don Hellman is a professor emeritus at the Jackson School, an expert on foreign policy, Russia, East Asia. Professor, thanks a lot for this.
My pleasure.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the program at KUOW. Tonight, you could see a clown if you want to. Cirque du Soleil clown Jeff Roz is speaking at Hale's Brewery as part of Seattle's annual Moisture Festival. I know, I said the M word. I'm sorry. That's what it's called. Seattle started the Moisture Festival in 2004. It's a theater festival, and this is before America decided it despised the word moist. Here to discuss words that we love and hate is former Merriam-Webster lexicographer Corey Stamper. Her new book is called Word by Word. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks so much for having me.
Moist tops the American list of hated words?
I think so. It's pretty high up there.
Why?
You know, I think some people don't like the combination of sounds in it, the M and the L that goes with it. I think some people, the word association with what gets called moist, people tend to go, ew, gross. They associate it with bodily functions.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think most of it is, you know, it's kind of a viral thing. It's low stakes. You can hate it. It's not a controversial opinion. And you know, it's a word that you can hate that nobody will contradict you about.
Yes. That's kind of my theory about these things that come up. This is a recent phenomenon, right? I grew up, cakes were moist. That was the nicest thing you could say. Seattle is moist.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you want your skin to be moist. You put moisturizer on. But just, it's recent. It's the last few years.
Yeah, it seems to be the last few years. And you're right. Moist just goes with certain words, like moist cake. Mm. You don't want wet cake.
Yeah.
A damp cake, that's grosser than moist cake.
So when all of a sudden everybody hated moist, I thought, you know, that I think that's because, and I relate to this, it feels really good to have an opinion, strong opinion about something. And if the stakes are high, well, that's scary. But if there's really nothing at stake at all, you might as well attach yourself to the idea to be one of those people who just hates the word moist.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and it feels kind of good.
Yeah. I like to tell people who hate moist that there is a worse word.
Really?
To hate. Yeah.
What is it?
The verb moistify.
Oh.
Everyone in the studio just jumped.
Yes, we have our professional tweeter, our social media producer, Bree Ripley, is sitting on my left, and she flinched visibly at the word moistify.
Moistify.
So again, language advisor, I apologize for that. On Facebook, Kelly writes to us that she doesn't like the word mucus because it sounds like what it is. And that I can understand.
Right.
Like, you know, moist could be a cake, but most cakes are delicious without having any, little or no mucus in them.
That is true. Yeah. They probably should not have any mucus in them.
Is there a word that you hate?
You know, so professionally, I love all words, but I absolutely have feelings and opinions just like anyone else. I really dislike the word impactful.
That's near the top of our list on Facebook. Impactful.
Yeah.
Why do you have a problem with that?
I think it just sounds too jargony. It's sort of, I think it's overused. But, you know, I mean, professionally, honestly, I've had to revise the entry for impactful. So
why?
Because every, you know, 10 years or so, we go through the dictionary A to Z, and you just look to see, does this have any new meaning? Does it have any new connotation we need to cover? And impactful happened to be one of the words I was assigned. And so I read a whole lot of businessy, jargony things that use the word impactful. So, but you know, it's stuck around in the language. It's got to have a place and a reason for being there.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So first of all, you don't like it because it's jargony. What is that about? That's a lot of Facebook posters. They don't like impactful. They don't like deliverables,
right,
and monetize. What's psychologically behind that?
I think part of it is the people dislike business jargon because it's an inside language. It's jargon. And people often complain that business jargon dilutes the meaning of language, right? Instead of saying deliverables, why don't you just say the thing you bought? Or instead of saying monetize, sort of rewrite it and say, this is how we're making money. But the fact is that, you know, business jargon, there's lots of jargon that doesn't seep out into the broader language. And the jargon that does, like monetize and impactful and deliverables, they have application beyond business. But people dislike business jargon in general because they don't like anything that sounds kind of squirrely.
Like, it sounds BS-y.
Yeah, too. Totally. Yeah.
Nicole writes, I hate the word impactful, but now find myself using it more and more in my nonprofit work due to peer pressure and word count limits in grant applications.
Absolutely.
And the word count, that's a thing, because the both examples you gave, monetize and deliverable, you said, why not just say things we can make money from? But those are all many, many words. If there is one word, for example, I feel the itch about jargon. I resist it too. I mean, this is my job to write. But the word parenting, I had the same reaction that everyone did. But I got to say, when someone says parenting, I know exactly what they mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't there something to be said for one word? I'm sorry it's new, but it is efficient and descriptive.
Right. And I think that you've touched on something that is a big complaint of people's. They talk about hating words because they are new. And there is this perception that the word is new. We already have words that must describe this. New things are degrading the language. And the fact is that's actually how language thrives, is through new words being coined and being spread abroad. And there are lots of words that are business jargon that just stay within one industry or don't last for very long. And, you know, the ones that do, that's actually a sign that the language is doing great.
Sounds like impactful might be here for a while.
It's definitely going to be here for a while.
much as even lexicographer Corey Stamper doesn't like it. Yeah, deliverable, actionable was another one on people's list on Facebook. I noticed people not liking, is abbreviation the word, OMG?
OMG,
LOL.
Yeah, you can call it an abbreviation or an initialism. Or an acronym. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it the same thing? What do people not like about acronyms?
I think what people don't like about acronyms, and especially ones like OMG and LOL, is they're associated with young people. And we hate young people. I mean, that's sort of this trope that has been in English literally since the 12th century, that young people are ruining the language.
Uh-huh.
And so people hate OMG because they feel like it's texting jargon, it's young people being lazy. The best thing about OMG is that OMG actually goes back to 1917. And it was first used in a letter to Winston Churchill from an admiral in the British Navy.
You cannot get more cred than the grammar Nazi crowd than bringing up, which he literally fought the Nazis.
Since one, literally.
Yeah. Yeah. So, thank you for the literally. That's two. Okay. So you might be a century old and use the word OMG.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's, by the way, in case you don't know, oh my God.
Right? It is indeed, oh my God. And in fact, the very first written use we have for it uses OMG, and then in parentheses, that admiral writes, oh my God. So we know that the OMG he uses is the OMG we use today.
Yeah.
OMG.
OMG. That's my reaction to that news. We're talking to a lexicographer, former Merriam-Webster lexicographer, Corey Stamper, and her new book is called Word by Word. And here we turned on the bat signal on the roof at KUOW, asked for some input. And do you know Matthew Inman from the comic strip? You know Oatmeal?
I know.
Good, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Well, he lives around here, a friend of the show, and here was his reaction.
Hey, okay. This is Matthew Inman. I'm the author of The Oatmeal. And the word I hate today is Q, as in line. And the reason for this is when you spell it, you can actually say the entire word just by spelling the first letter. You spell the letter Q, and you're good. And then every letter after that is just like that guy who hangs around at the end of a party after everybody has left. It's just a string of ooh, 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 ooh after the party's over. It's like, go home.
I guess he may be making a case for just spelling Q, Q.
I think that's the case he's making. And, you know, I'm down with that. I do have to say the word Q, Q-U-E-U-E, is a pretty old word. And it's been around for about 300 years now. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it's so squirrely, the reason it has all of these extra letters, is we can blame French for that, because we actually took it directly from French. And if we had thought about it, we could have shortened it, but we just took it from French and we got used to saying Q-U-E-U-E. And there it is.
But if you shorten a French word, now we're back to OMG. People would think that's lazy and lowbrow to shorten a European word.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It is a catch-22.
How about people who text K instead of OK just to save one letter?
You know
what? Stick around?
What's fascinating about that? I don't know if that'll stick around, but there is a whole linguistics around whether you use OK, OKAY,
mm-hmm.
OK, OK, K, or KK.
KK?
KK.
It's dangerously close to KKK, though.
It is dangerously close. That's why we stop at two
okay.
in the texting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a linguistic study about this, and generally, particularly younger folks, and I know this because I have teenagers, and I had to learn this when I started texting them. If I text them OK, either the word or the two letters, they think I'm angry at them.
Really? If you
yes.
say OK, so they want K as
they
like reassurance that you're being jaunty and casual?
Yeah. Just a single K is a way of saying, OK, I got what you're saying and I'm going to do or say or whatever. And KK is a more genial way of saying, all right,
oh,
thanks.
So KK is even sweeter.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, lowercase or uppercase?
So I do the uppercase, lowercase. My kids do both lowercase. Well, that's not true. My youngest does both lowercase. My eldest does uppercase, lowercase.
Because some people, now we're into whether an uppercase letter means you're yelling.
Right. And, you know, I have kids and they know I yell, so I figure they'll get over it.
And this isn't quite a word, but speaking of this kind of thing that you have to show that you're I'm being non-threatening here. Everything's okay. Is the exclamation point? I find that it's everywhere. It's as if you don't put exclamation points, and even better would be multiple ones.
Mm-hmm.
Then people will assume that you're being dour or you're scolding them or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I refuse. I'm keeping the exclamation point out and let people think what they will. But maybe that makes me a jerk on.
Well, you know, I think there's something to be said for both things. I think, you know, when you get through the American educational system, you learn, particularly in formal writing or business writing or anything like that, that you want to stay away from exclamation marks because that's, you know, the joke is you get three to use in a lifetime.
Yes.
And you don't want to use them all at once. But I also think that we use so much written communications just for everyday stuff now. We text about things. We email constantly. Nobody makes phone calls anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are some people who are reclaiming the exclamation mark as a way of sort of bringing tone and register to an email. So sometimes if I'm setting up an appointment with somebody I haven't seen in a while, I will use the exclamation mark, you know, can't wait to see you.
Yeah.
Because it just, you know.
But I can
hey.
Wait. I can wait to see you. I'm just looking forward to it, period. It's not really an exclamation mark. However, I love emojis. So
I'll
them out.
Yeah,
yeah
hey.
They're great.
Yeah.
Because you have so many choices, you don't have to misuse an exclamation mark. You can just throw something
yeah.
in that's approximate.
That's true.
On Facebook, by the way, we're talking about words that we love and hate and why with lexicographer Corey Stamper, author of the book Word by Word. And we're doing this on the occasion of the Moisture Festival in mm-hmm. Seattle. They may not have named it Moisture Festival if it were today because it's so apparently hated. On Facebook, John Tall writes, I hate hubby. I heard this from a lot of people, hubby. They don't like hubby. John Tall says, I hate hubby and prego for mm-hmm. pregnant, probably because the people who use the word hubby also use prego.
Well, there you have it. That's airtight logic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of words that get shortened like that that people hate because they sound infantilizing
yeah.
or cutesy. So I checked. Hubby is really interesting. Hubby actually goes back to the 1600s.
Really?
Yeah, which surprised me. I kind of thought maybe 1800s, but it goes back to the 1600s.
You thought maybe 1800s. I love
yeah.
that because there's we've talked about this a bit now that you that chances are the thing that you think is cutesy and juvenile
mm-hmm.
is probably really old.
Yeah. In fact, the whole thing of shortening words. This goes back to the 1200s, 1300s. There's a great poem that uses the word haps instead of happenings, sort of like
what's the haps?
And that's 1467, I think. So, yeah. So, you know, I mean, the thing about words, you're free to dislike whichever words you want.
Sure.
And that's fine. But I think what gets dicey is when you start making assumptions about people who are using the words that you dislike so much. Because
what's an example of an assumption?
So like the people who use hubby and prego. Let's use that because I'm not keen on hubby or prego either.
Yeah, I would not use those.
Yeah,
words.
I wouldn't. You know, you automatically have in your mind when you say I don't like hubby and prego, you have a picture in your mind of the type of people who use hubby and prego.
Unironically.
Yeah. And you sort of go, I'm not like those people. And so you immediately begin imbuing your dislike of this word. That transfers to your, you know, ties into this dislike of a type of person.
It's tribal.
Yeah. And that's when it starts. That's when personal preferences start getting a little dangerous linguistically, because I think we just assume the way that I talk is normal and the way everyone else talks is wrong.
Oh, yes. We are the good people.
That's
we
right.
know who the bad people are. Oh, amen. This is Lexicographer Corey Stamper. Let's see. Eileen says, I hate the word panties. That was off a big one on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maybe partly the infantilizing. But
yeah.
Now you're going down a sex road as well.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
mixes with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Nicole says, I hate the most words that don't exist but are often used, irregardless.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Irregardless might be the most hated word.
Even more than moist.
I think even more than moist.
I think you're right. It's had more staying power.
Yeah. You know, irregardless goes back to the 1700s, if you can believe it. And when it first came into English, it was completely normal. It really only started being seen as uneducated in the, you know, early to mid 1800s, when the people who originally used irregardless out in the country began moving into the cities. And this sort of gets into this idea of the language that I use is better than the language that you use. In the 1800s, in America, we started preferring the way that people in cities spoke, and the way that we talked about city language was it's educated, it's sophisticated. And so if that's educated and sophisticated, then obviously the people in the rural parts of the country must not be educated or sophisticated. So irregardless actually has a whole history of people saying it's really a terrible, uneducated, non-word. But the fact is it actually has enough print use in edited prose by really educated people to make it into the dictionary.
That surprises me because there is a redundancy to it, right? It seems like it was a mistake, even if it's a 100-year-old mistake, irregardless.
So when it first came into English, I have done some research on irregardless, and I actually think it was an emphatic form of regardless.
Oh.
It's sort of a way of, you know, can I have the car? No. You know, but dad, you know, regardless of the weather, I'm a good driver. And if my dad says, irregardless, you know, the conversation's over. We're
yes.
not having any further conversation.
Ah.
And so I think it has sort of this nuanced meaning that just doesn't translate well in print. Also, you know, a lot of English is really illogical. You know,
yes, yes.
We have inflammable, that means to set on fire. We have unthaw, that means to thaw.
Mm-hmm.
Ravel can mean both to knit up and to unknit. So, you know, I mean, this is a feature of English and not a bug.
I always had, tell me if my theory is wrong, that one reason people don't like that others get to use something like irregardless is it's like what education I have is kind of like money in my bank. It's like it's something I own. It's something I have that's valuable. And if people can say irregardless and get away with it, then it's devaluing. Then the fact that I know that irregardless is wrong just lost its value. So it's like you're inflationary. You're deflating the value of my assets.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm not proud of that.
Yeah. Oh, no. You know, I think the thing is it is human nature to want to be the smartest person in the room. I mean, everybody does this, even lexicographers. And I think that once you start looking at the way English actually moves and changes, and you start realizing that a lot of these things that you think are just flat out wrong actually have a particular context where they're not wrong, you do get defensive because we spend a lot of years of our lives learning all of these really crazy rules that about English and what are good words and what are bad words. And
right.
The minute you learn that it's not about good or bad, but it's about context, if you have made your entire identity about, I know that irregardless is a bad word, well, then, yeah, that's threatening.
Exactly. Better put. You're good with words. Her book is Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. This is a lexicographer Corey Stamper. We got, and by the way, I noticed you said a couple times, you said the fact is, and the thing is. Those are things that I avoid. Tell me about why you, lexicographer, are okay with the thing is.
You know, so it's called the double copula. And it's a habit that I've gotten into. And it's also kind of typical of my particular dialect of English. People see the fact is as sort of a marker of an introductory, you know, noun phrase.
Uh-huh.
And then the fact is that.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
I'm not judging you.
Well, I get called out for it quite a bit.
Really?
I do.
I'm not the first.
You're not.
No offense.
No, I take no offense.
But do you feel, you said that we all have our own idiolects.
Yes.
And sometimes it can be a source of judgment.
Oh,
right?
Of course.
If it's not prestige. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so an idiolect is your own personal way of speaking, and it combines sort of your dialects, which tend to be the varieties of English that you grow up speaking or that you're exposed to. So my dialect is general Western American English, but I now live in a place that speaks Mid-Atlantic English, and so my idiolect is a weird combination of general Western American English, so I will say howdy, and Mid-Atlantic English, so I will say hoagie and use the Philly word John. So
what's John?
John is the most amazing word. John is basically a word that substitutes in for thing.
How do you spell it?
J-A-W-N.
Oh.
But it can mean thing, it can refer to a situation, it can refer to a person. So you will hear on the buses in Philly someone say, oh yeah, he's got a side John, meaning he's got someone on the side.
It sounds kind of like joint to me.
It is actually exactly from joint.
So I could do this all day, as you know. I want to leave on just a few happy notes. We've been talking about words we hate. Carlin loves the word sesquipedalia.
Oh, yeah.
You know it?
Oh, sesquipedalian's great.
Carlin says it means long words, literally words that are a foot and a half long.
Yep.
I love the idea of going 50% farther than you should, trying not twice as hard, but 50% harder. It makes it seem more achievable.
Yeah, it's a great word.
Do you have another word you love?
You know, I really love the word gardy-loo.
What's that?
Gardy-loo is spelled G-A-R-D-Y-L-O-O. And the reason I love it is because it seems ridiculous to me that it exists at all. It is an interjection that is defined as used as a warning cry in Edinburgh when it was customary to throw slops from upper stories. And it's part of why I love it is, it's just a funny sounding word, but also the fact that it's so specific, used only in Edinburgh in a time when you threw waste out the upper stories, and that it has enough written use to make it into a dictionary is just magical to me.
Finally on Facebook, Bob says, I love the word ephemeral because it sounds beautiful, though its beauty lasts just a moment.
Oh, well done.
Corey Stamper is the author of Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, out on by Vintage. And we're talking on the occasion of Seattle's Moisture Festival. Despite that name, we've turned on that name since it began. It was a pleasure. Cor, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
More of the record coming up in a moment. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Airlines have been in an arms race for profit margins since forever, and it feels like they're transferring most of these costs to you and me. You pay for carry-on bags, extra legroom, Wi-Fi. But according to my next guest, the in-flight entertainment costs might actually be worth it. Stephen Greening is a professor of cinema and media studies at the University of Washington. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the most outlandish things airlines have tried?
So there was a system in the mid-60s called AstroColor, which was American Airlines' attempt to compete with TWA. And at the time, they were having sort of a little bit of a war where American Airlines showed their films on these small TV monitors in black and white and sort of a square screen, whereas TWA showed their films on large screens at the front of the cabin as they could be seen in the movie theater. So American Airlines said, okay, we have to have color film, but we want to have the small screens. So what they said is, we are going to get this system where the film winds through the luggage rack of the airplane. So it circulates through the entire airplane. So you have about 300 feet of film unspooled in the luggage rack of the plane. And of course, there were all sorts of mechanical problems because that's a lot of film to have going through a lot of gears. There were sound problems, these sorts of things. So that's one of the more outlandish things.
Astrocolor. You might not know of it because it didn't survive.
It did not survive. It only lasted a couple of years. And it was preceded by a system called Astrovision, which was one of the first systems to have external cameras on the airplane. There were a couple on the wings and one in the cockpit, so you could watch your plane take off and land from the pilot's eye view.
That seems like the last thing many flyers want to look
right,
at or think about.
Exactly. So they advertised it as a thrill, you know, it's kind of like a roller coaster. It's fun. It's as late as 1979, the Astrovision system was still on a DC-10 that crashed above O'Hare Airport right after it took off. And people don't know this for sure, but they speculate that the system was on. So passengers basically watched their own crash through these television screens that were inside the cabin.
Oh, my God. Were there survivors?
There were no survivors for this crash.
Yes.
And in-flight entertainment has some inherent risks because there's so much wiring in the current systems. There's always a risk of fire or short circuit or these kinds of things. That has been lessened now. But in the 90s, there were, between I think 1998 and 2003, there were about 60 fires on planes caused by the wiring of in-flight entertainment systems. So only one of those resulted in a crash, as far as I know. But there's this tension between, on the one hand, in-flight entertainment being there to help us get through the flight, to ease the anxiety of travel,
yeah,
to make us feel more comfortable and entertained, to make the flight seem less tedious, and that at the same time, these in-flight entertainment systems have this small potential for danger themselves.
But don't most flyers have their own personal movie gadgets now? I haven't watched an in-flight movie in years.
So these days, the airlines, partly because of the crash in 2008.
You mean the financial crash of 2008?
Yes. Because of the high cost of fuel and financial difficulties, airlines tried to save money by taking out the in-flight entertainment systems in the economy class cabin. And they also realized that, as you said, most passengers bring on a device of their own. A lot of people travel with laptops or phones. A few years ago, I sat next to these two young women who were watching Ferris Bueller's Day Off on a portable DVD player, which was great for me because I didn't need headphones. I have the movie memorized.
Sure.
So it was fun.
You know what he's saying in the shower. Life
exactly,
moves pretty fast.
Exactly, yes. So this tactic basically means that in the first class cabins of airplanes, they have to provide an environment that is better than you can get with your laptop. So that means that the screens have to be larger. They have to have the latest films. And so really the concentration of money and attention has been on these first class pods on these transoceanic flights. In economy class, it's really up to you. You're on your own.
And one thing that makes that tolerable is Wi-Fi. Why do I have to pay $10 for Wi-Fi?
That's a great question. I don't know exactly why it is $10, but I will say that, as you know, my research has shown that the antenna on most of the planes to pick up the satellite signal, which gives you Wi-Fi, creates enough drag that it's equivalent to 5 extra passengers. So the airline has to recoup this. It's basically you're talking about having unpaying passengers, the equivalent of unpaying passengers on the plane. So you're sort of subsidizing that antenna by paying for Wi-Fi. And it wouldn't surprise me that overall the airlines are probably not making a lot of money.
Okay, well, that makes me feel slightly less cheated. But knowing what you know, how do you want us to think differently about our in-flight entertainment?
I think, for one thing, that we expect travel to to be effortless, to be painless, and at the same time, somewhat contradictorily, it is something to be endured. And this is a bit of a problem, it seems to me, because at one time, travel was something that you experienced, that built character. You learned new things. You became a better person. You had a more open mind. And now, you know, you can travel through the airport, get on the little train that takes you to your gate, go walk through the gate, get on the airplane, get off the airplane, then you get in the taxi or the light rail or whatever, and you get into the hotel, which is the same as the hotel in the town you left from. All of this, there's no sense of change. And so people, I think, tend to resent air travel. But all of that is sort of in contradiction to how travel used to be, right? And another local hero here in the Northwest, Rick Steves, would tell you, you know, you sort of have to work when you travel to get something from it. And one of the things that I think Americans in particular, one of their viewpoints about air travel is that it should be easy. I shouldn't have to do anything and it shouldn't change me. I shouldn't be changed by it. But I would suggest that maybe people should think a little bit more about how amazing some of these technologies are and what sorts of opportunities that gives them to grow, to change, to learn. Travel might turn into something more exciting and adventurous and less of an ordeal.
So maybe think about that flight and the technology of the flight as a journey in itself or an experience
yes.
in itself
yes,
and not
exactly.
just their job is to right. make it so I blink and I'm in another hotel.
Right. I mean, which is essentially how in-flight entertainment has been marketed by airlines. So it's not the passenger's fault necessarily that that's sort of the framework, the mental framework in which we enter into travel, because certainly airlines are saying, you know, it will make the journey seem quicker.
Yeah.
It will make it seem easier. We have to have these things because it calms people down. We have to have in-flight entertainment because people are bored and they're anxious about traveling. And instead of confronting that anxiety head on, instead of talking about it and empathizing with it, we're distracted from it.
I get it. Travel is arduous. That's
right.
Why they don't call it staying on your couch.
Exactly. Although we kind of want to be couch potatoes in the airplane cabin, that's for sure.
Thanks for making us stop and think about it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Professor Stephen Greening teaches cinema and media studies at the University of Washington. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. The show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimibrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with Seattle Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. What do you want me to ask her about? Seattle's Russian consulate, gun regulations, Stormy Daniels. Let us know. Write us an email at record@kuow.org. Thanks for listening.